So, would you guys consider the Night's Watch? It's not really like a government. Would you consider it a culture?
It's more of a gang.
But right. Like it.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Bite Marks. I'm Emilio, pronouns he, him, and I'm joined by my lovely co-host, Callum.
Hi, I'm Callum, pronouns he, him.
And if we're talking about Game of Thrones, then we've got to have our lovely guest, Hillary.
Hi, I'm Hillary, aka Hills Alive on YouTube. I am she, her.
Cool. So today we have gathered the Council of Maesters together.
Gross.
We've all brought in our heavy chains.
Gross. Stop electing me into positions.
Well, it's your father was had to get rid of you. You were like a third son, so you know you just got shuffled off to become a maester.
That's a real close to life. But my dad is very nice if he's watching this.
Yeah, Callum's dad is pretty good. So we're here to talk about something which is I think in a lot of ways is the exact reason why a podcast like this was created, because this is going to get a little bit experimental, y'all. So the topic for today is talking about evolving...
Wait, hang on. This is why our gaming podcast was created, to talk about Game of Thrones. I'm not sure. I had a different view for it in mind, but I'll let you continue.
Yeah, so... Okay, not our gaming podcast, but a podcast in general, you know.
This is why a different podcast was created, but we're here now.
Yeah. Gladys and Alt-Shift-X were recording something about food, I don't know, so, like, we're filling in the gap.
Everyone's going a little bit crazy.
Yeah. We're all just waiting for the wins. So I wanted to talk about something which I think is really important, and it's something that shows up, I think, as a thematic thread, but not really something that you've ever addressed, Hillary, which is feudalism sucks.
Yes.
That's the title of the episode right there.
Feudalism sucks real bad, and it causes so many problems in Westeros, but nothing ever seems to be done about it. You know, I don't think George is writing A Song of Ice and Fire as like a defender of feudalism, but it does seem that like feudalism is inevitable in his world. Wouldn't you say so?
Yes, I would tend to agree. Again, based on specifically in Westeros, like obviously we look at places in Essos that have sort of pseudo city state regions where a more developed government is probably possible. But when you're talking about a place like Westeros that is so far apart where communication is so difficult, and when you're talking about the fact that there are people who have literal magical powers or magical bloodlines, it does make sense that certain families, certain people establish a foothold of power that becomes generational.
Yeah, so in the real world, there...
No, I'm sorry, I just like the idea of Ted from the farm down the road really worrying about sword legislation this summer, while the anime protagonist who lives in the castle above him is getting really worried about their giant wolf is so fucking hilarious to me. You wrote an anime, George. You thought you could get it past us, but you wrote an anime.
Well, George is like a hippie from the 70s, isn't he?
I don't know.
I feel like that.
I've never met him.
He's old. Yeah, he's an old man. But anyway, one of the problems is that like feudalism is a prevalent system in Westeros. It keeps causing all of these problems. And, you know, George has explicitly stated that the world of A Song of Ice and Fire is very heavily based on like our real world history, you know, things like War of the Roses, period England, and other various sorts of things. But the problem is, feudalism in our time lasted less time than it did in Westeros. It kept being prolonged. And we're here to discuss a bunch of different things related to what we could do. Well, firstly, why is feudalism so long-lived in Westeros, or just in general, right? The name of the planet escapes me. What is it called?
Planetos.
Hillary, help me.
Usually.
Planetos, yeah. I knew it was something dumb like that.
Is it called Planetos?
I mean, I don't think that's the official name. I think fans just sort of like extrapolated that that is what it would be called based on the names of all of the other continents.
Oh, okay. Because, like, I remember the planet that Skyrim's on is called Nirn, and that's why they have a plant there called Nirn Root, because it's supposed to be like Earth Root.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why I brought that up. I'm recovering from an illness right now. And I'm kind of all over the place. But yeah, Planetos is dumb. It sounds like the Greek god of round things.
Right.
At least it's not called, like, I don't know, some other like a German word for Earth.
Like Nirn or something stupid like that.
Right.
Fucking Todd.
This is a call out for Bethesda. We're coming for you. Yeah, so we're going to talk about why is it so long-lived. What are, you know, some of the examples where it deviates from the norm, and a couple of other ideas, you know, related to that. So, Hillary, why don't you start us off? Why do you think feudalism has survived for so long? For, like, I think thousands of years, like a really long time in Westeros, in the world of Planetos.
Yeah, so I think that obviously George tends to scale his stories in a very sort of long period of time. It's not just feudalism where certain people or systems are in power for an exceptionally long time in comparison to what you'd think of in the real world. But I think that feudalism has gained such a stronghold, again, because Westeros is large. It's not very technologically developed. I think that probably the cultural differences between the different kingdoms makes a difference. Also, when you obviously consider that Westeros has only been united as a country for a couple of hundred years, so it's not that strange that the government hasn't calcified into something more centralized yet. And I think that, in a weird way, I think that obviously the existence of magic probably had an effect on almost sort of hindering the development of technology, if that makes sense. That because magic existed, people weren't focused on making more technological advances that might make a more developed government easier.
Possible.
I mean, yeah, think about, like, a lot of our technological advancements come through war, and most wars in Westeros were won by one side having dragons and the other side not having dragons.
Right. I mean, well, yeah, I think prior to the Targaryen invasion, obviously the other kingdoms went to war with one another at other times, but and the existence of magic in Westeros is kind of an odd thing, because obviously in certain instances like the Starks, their magic was latent, was dormant for thousands of years, for long enough that they forgot that they actually had these magical powers. But there are other families like the Hightowers, the Danes, the Reeds, that where it's sort of implied, it's at least implied, it's not directly stated, that they still are aware of their magical abilities and know how to use them, which obviously would give them an enormous advantage over almost anyone else when they're going into battle or just trying to maintain political control.
Remember, folks, if you're worried that your family might have latent magical powers, just break your little brother's legs. A magic tree man will call him in the evening, and then you'll know.
No, that is a good point, both of you. I think something which is very, very important to contextualize the development of democracy in our world is that, generally speaking, people will believe in things that they are sort of like able to believe in, or aware of, right? One of the major problems with Westeros is that education is basically extremely concentrated in the 1% of society. Outside of, I think, the maesters, I don't know what, like, the general literacy rate of Westeros is, but it's probably not very good.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, given that it's repeatedly reference that there are even people in the noble class who are illiterate.
Expectation
that like normal people would be literate is, you know, absurd.
That's actually something, a detail that I find really interesting that George, you know, wrote in this, like, yeah, even a good percentage of the nobility is also illiterate, you know? Whereas in medieval times, I know we have this tendency to think of medieval people as being dumb, but generally speaking, the upper classes, they were quite literate to a large degree. Certainly it would be unusual to find a noble person who couldn't read at least a little bit, you know? So the fact that literacy is so, you know, hampered, and like in real life, literacy was so necessary for the development and spreading of ideas, you know, that's like, that is a, you know, it's a major hurdle. The other hurdle is, of course, you know, generally speaking, for the past couple hundred years, the people who have been in charge have had dragons, and, you know, it's very hard to beat a dragon.
Right.
Yeah, in a fight.
Well, I mean, no, you just get, like, your friend's drunk uncle to shoot it 3 times with a harpoon.
Right.
And it's super easy to kill a dragon, guys.
Yeah, you did... that is right.
Speaking of the Ironborn, isn't it wild that they have a king's moot, and what could that mean for the future of Westeros?
So that actually is a nice segue into this. So feudalism is a prevalent ideology, but it's not every single ideology. You know, there are examples where we could point to in the text where people don't immediately have a squabble over who's dad was actually the king. One example of those are the Ironborn and how they hold a king's moot. And correct me if I'm wrong, but in the king's moot, they basically gather all the people of significance on the Iron Isles, and they just elect somebody.
Someone has to make a claim, but anyone can do it.
Yeah. It's about, in a weird way, it's kind of much closer to like a small hunter-gatherer society where anyone who wants the job can be like, stand up on a rock and go, you guys should put me in charge. And then he does like a flex.
I mean, no, it's more like on a pirate crew when they're trying to elect a new captain.
That is a good metaphor for the Ironborn.
Yeah.
Although I have my doubts how they could build so many ships, but that's a...
Yeah, no, it's bullshit. But basically, anyone on the Iron Islands can say, I want to be king, and then they declare what they're going to give to people to be king. They can bring gifts or whatever to make their case a bit more rock solid, like Euron did. Or they can just make, like, declarations, like Asha did.
Hmm. Yeah, it's not exactly a democracy, right? Because obviously I think the implication here is that what people are doing and why Euron wins is because he's basically buying votes.
Right.
Yeah, so it's exactly like a democracy.
Well, I don't know. What do you think, Hillary?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there are a much more... it's much more democratic than pretty much every other governing system in Westeros. I think it's interesting because obviously the Iron Islands is a fairly culturally isolated culturally isolated culture. That's very well phrased.
They're sea bumpkins.
Right. Well, they also have sort of an interesting advantage when it comes to democracy in comparison to a lot of the other places, in that A, that the Iron Islands are way smaller than every other kingdom in the country, and by virtue of the fact that they are seafarers, they are capable of intercommunicating a lot easier than, say, you know, the people in the north are.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So, would you guys consider the Night's Watch? It's not really like a government. Would you consider it a culture?
It's more of a gang.
But, right. Like, it definitely has its own little, like, cultural sphere.
So, I guess the thing that connects the two is that, like, one reason... So, you're bringing up the fact that the member of the Night's Watch is basically in an elected position, right? Somebody has to be voted for it amongst all of the Night's Watchmen. I think one reason why that is the case, and also to point back to your issue about the Iron Islanders' culture, is that the person who is going to rule them is in a very unique position because they're not as insulated from the consequences of their failures, right?
Yeah.
If the ruler of the Ironborn is a bad king, someone's going to stab him in the back or throw him off a bridge or do something to him.
Right.
You know, in earlier times, presumably, the leader of the Night's Watch had a lot of, you know, additional stuff. But even then, you know, he starts to deal with the people beyond the wall and stuff like that.
Yeah, but the Night's Watch, the Lord Commander, rules from Castle Black. But there are other castles. And they're not all in the same place.
That's true, but I still, you know, he's less insulated from failure than, say, Joffrey would be in King's Landing.
Yeah, right? No, definitely. It's a much grander scale, but even so, I would say that there's maybe a tougher time communicating than, say, the Ironborn have.
Hmm. That's true, but I think here's a multiplicity of factors, right? I think when there is a pressure for merit, right? I think one major issue that we have with Westeros is that they don't have a meritocracy. Oftentimes, and this is a point that you bring up in a lot of your videos, oftentimes the people who are put in positions of power are not prepared for it at all. Like Rhaenyra at the Dance of the Dragons, right?
Yeah.
She's not actually prepared to rule, even though she's given all this responsibility, or at least the expectation of responsibility. When you see more democratic institutions emerging, it's because the person who is meant to be in charge is not as insulated from the consequences of failure, you know? And I think that's like a theme. Because isn't it also applicable for the Sea Lord of Braavos?
Well, he's super insulated from the consequences of his failure. He has a literal guard. And like the best swordsman in the city looking after him. Plus, Braavos is enormous. It's a series of islands.
Okay, well, Braavos is the counterexample. It's a merchant republic, right? That's what it's sort of based on, like, real-world Venice, if I'm not mistaken.
Sure. That sounds right.
Yeah.
as a non-government expert, that sounds accurate.
Yeah, so Braavos is, I guess, the other thing that comes to mind when you think about democracy, right? Because they're ruled by a guy called the Sea Lord, and the Sea Lord is elected to his position in the same way that the Doge of Venice was elected to his position. It's not a hereditary position, but it is a position for life, which of course has some issues when the Doge is like 70 years old and his brain is turned to mush.
Then he is no longer a good boy.
Yeah.
That's for all of you who have been on the internet for too long. Touch some grass.
Yeah, but okay. So this Braavos is the other side of, because like I think democracy flourishes in two particular circumstances, right? It's either you've got a small group of people who are relatively tight knit together and who need their leader to at least be somehow, you know, capable, so they have to come up with some kind of at least almost fair way of choosing them, or you have a very complicated society where a lot of the systems of government have been abstracted to the point that, like, now, you know, we need to build a machine, and we need to elect a person to run the machine. Whereas I think feudalism sits in the middle of these two spectrums.
Well,
and Braavos, by the fact it's like a merchant society, it's much more mercantilist than Westeros is. I think that's like why maybe that developed.
Okay, what about Mance Rayder? He was elected king of the free folk. What side does he fall into on the spectrum?
I mean, I think to call him elected doesn't feel quite right. I mean, like the wildlings obviously follow him, but he sort of brought together a bunch of disparate groups and was like, we need to unite behind this common cause. So it wasn't necessarily, his position as a leader isn't really politically motivated. It's literally driven by the fact that all of the wildlings are in mortal danger, and he's basically the one who got the ball rolling on uniting them and making sure that they had the means to survive.
True, but that doesn't deny the fact that he is a leader in a political position.
No, I agree that he is a leader. I just think that to consider him like democratically elected isn't quite right.
Okay, well, in this now triangular spectrum, we have leader by necessity, more mercantile leader.
So leader by abstraction.
Basically. Leader by abstraction, and leader because of...
consent, maybe.
Maybe more like circumstance or environment.
Well, so... To follow on to your point, I also agree with you, Hillary. I don't necessarily think Mansurata counts as being elected. I think it's kind of like everyone was in a life or death situation and they were looking for somebody to take the reins, you know, because nobody wanted to be in charge. And Mance was the guy who was just the most competent of their available options.
Is that...
And it wasn't so much that they elected him, it's just that they started treating him as if he was the leader in a practical sense, and he never said no. I think that's...
And is
maybe a,
would you say that's why they chose to follow Jon Snow after Mance died?
Yeah. I think they were just in a precarious position, you know, because you can't really have a democracy in a life or death kind of situation, right?
You can't really give your consent if the only other option is die.
Is death. Yeah, exactly. Right. That's like... So that's why I think it's like either you've got the Ironborn who are like, oh, yeah, I want to find a pirate king who's going to get me lots of gold, or you've got... in Bravo, so it's like, okay, well, we should elect a guy who's going to get me lots of gold.
Okay, what about Karth? What's the government of Karth again? It's like the 13 rulers of Karth. Are they a senate? Or are they mercantile?
I mean, I'd say they're more almost like an oligarchy, sort of. I wouldn't necessarily... I mean, I think that there's obviously sort of a... economic driving force. A lot of the people who are a part of the 13 are economically powerful, but you have people like it's not necessarily completely driven by economics, and a lot of it is about, or well, I guess, I mean, I can't say this for sure, but I think a lot of what they do is about governing for their own benefit, if that makes sense.
I have the wiki page here if you guys want to hear.
Sure.
Okay.
The government of Karth is an oligarchy headed by a council of nobles and merchants known as the 13. Most of the representatives on this council are members of the Pureborn, an aristocracy descending from the long-deposed kings of Karth. Although they rule by consensus, any member of the 13 can overrule a decision made by the rest invoking Sumai, pledging their life and their blood to back up their decision.
Yeah, so they are an oligarchy.
Yeah, but it's almost hereditary still.
Yeah, so there is a common theme in all kinds of political governance. So, like, where does feudalism come from? Well, feudalism comes from warlordism, right? You don't have any kind of central authority. You have small groups of people who are trying to survive. Eventually, some of them get really good at killing their neighbors and decide to formalize their power that they've created by fighting. Literally, the foundation of every feudalistic society is always some warlord somewhere, and then that calcifies and turns into feudalism.
Wasn't that a famous thing in Game of Thrones, as someone said, like, all of the great houses were basically just thugs who were really good at killing each other?
Yeah, the founding myth of the Targaryens is they show up, destroy the other, they subjugate all the kingdoms and they put themselves in charge, you know.
They show up, and then slam down a checkers board, say, king me, everyone else says we're playing chess, and then they slap the board off the table.
No, they set the board on fire.
Pretty much.
And then eventually what we see is their rule gets calcified, and it is kind of funny, though, because the Targaryens rule more as absolute monarchs, not strictly speaking what we consider to be like feudalistic monarchs.
I would say that the Targaryens rule almost as a theocracy.
Really?
Because they are almost religious figures.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, I think that's sort of an interesting take on it. Like, I don't necessarily disagree, but, like, when you think of a theocracy, you think of, like, someone who is devoted to a god, whereas these people literally see themselves as gods.
But they're devoted to themselves.
Right, but again, like, I don't know. I mean, I guess I don't know a ton about theocracies, but I always consider theocrats to be devoted to an external force. And even if they think, like, I'm chosen by that force, they don't necessarily think that they're, like, literally gods among men in the way that the Targaryens seem to.
Well, folks, dust off your tinfoil and bear with me on this. I think that the Targaryens believe that their dragons are, like, gods, or maybe at least their sort of ticket to godhood. And that initially they probably didn't think that. They were probably normal people who thought, like, these are some really powerful monsters that we can use to take over places. But that kind of perpetuated this idea that they are better than everyone else. And they kind of spread that idea to their citizens, and that becomes the narrative. And so it's almost a theocracy based on the belief of dragons.
I'm going to have to disagree with that take.
I mean, the money is a golden dragon.
No, that is... Look, I think Hillary is correct, right? When you have a theocracy, the foundational idea of a theocracy is that the person who is in charge, the theocrat, they are ruling on a divine mandate based on some other external power, right? The source of the theocracy's legitimacy is, oh, we are endowed by God to rule. Targaryen claim to power is, we are the gods, therefore we rule. Those are distinct kinds of systems. You know, it is arguably to some extent religious, but I don't think the Targaryens really see of themselves as, like, they don't try to convert anyone to Targaryenism. You know, they famously have loads of conflicts with the existing religious institution in Westeros. They never really try to hijack it. Or what you never see is them trying to turn the Faith of the Seven into, like, you know, the Faith of the Eight, or whatever. You know, they never tried to...
The Dragonborn.
they never tried to do anything like that. And that's just not how theocracies work. In real life, every theocracy that I can think of has always tried to maintain that kind of religious supremacy. Whereas the Targaryens are about their own separate kind of supremacy, you know, almost like a genetic supremacy.
Imperialism.
Yeah, it's like a...
Sorry, Hillary, Hillary, you were going to say something?
Oh, no, just that I agree that it's more of, like, a genetic supremacy. I think that obviously, you know, there are very, like, overt references to Nazism in the Targaryens and the Valyrians in general. And again, that it's more, I mean, I do think that the Targaryens sort of see themselves as gods among men, but they're also, like, sort of exceptionally irreligious characters. Like, even if they think that they're sort of godlike, they don't really have religion whatsoever. Even their old religion, like the old religions from Valyria, might influence them, but they're not, like, religious people, generally.
Maybe it's more like, like Japanese imperialism, where, like, the emperor... Because they came from the Valyrian Empire, maybe the emperor... In this case, the king is considered to be, like, the god on Earth?
Not really, because it is about power, right? It's all about power for the Targaryens. And I think... Almost, you know, you're kind of correct in the sense that, like, I think it is... Very close to fascism, actually.
Right.
It's very, very close to fascism in the sense that, like, the Targaryens believe they are genetically superior to everybody else, and because they are the blood of the dragon, and therefore that entitles them to rule. But they're also weirdly uninterested. It's like, you know, the Targaryens will occasionally have children with people outside of their family. You know, they don't all... practice this really crazy, massive, like, inbreeding. You know, you would think that if they were so obsessed with their genes that they would, you know, try something like that.
Give them a wash every now and again. Jeez.
But, yeah, I guess the Targaryens are an example of a society... Okay, so you know how the Jedi Council...
Yeah, let's bring in more phantoms.
Okay, so you know how the Jedi are like a political institution in the Republic?
Yeah, yeah. They're the police.
Yeah, but the reason why they have power is because they're magical.
I mean,
almost in a way.
Well, yeah, but also because they're desperately violent.
Yeah, well, the Targaryens are like that as well. They're kind of magical in the sense that they can control the magical super weapon.
The gold cloaks of the Jedi Council. You heard it here first.
No, in the metaphor, the Targaryens are like the Jedi. I guess the Sith. And
no,
the gold cloaks.
I guess Dorne would be the Sith.
Oh, God. No.
Let's not do this. Anyway, back to politics. What's another country?
What's it
in this big old wacky world? What's happening in YT right now?
I think they're doing something. Hillary, go ahead.
Honestly have no idea what their governing system is at present. No,
it's definitely an absolute monarchy. They have an emperor.
Yeah, I think they would be doing something similar to like Imperial China or Imperial Japan.
Yeah, it's
that's presumably what they're modeled official. Off of. Yeah.
Okay. There's that. There's the Dothraki, which is tribal patriarchy.
Yeah, actually, you know, that brings me to a sort of a segue, right? So you mentioned, you know, technology. I also think one of the major problems that people have in Westeros is just thinking that they actually could govern, right? One of the reasons why democracy developed in the real world is basically because you had people who were excluded from political power, but had a lot of power nevertheless, right? I'm talking about what we would call, in a Marxist sense, the bourgeoisie.
Right.
The wealthy people of society, like merchants, who were ostensibly denied political power or social power because they weren't of the right bloodline, but they had a lot of money, so they could still do stuff.
Mm.
And those people were the prime agitation for democracy, because they're like, okay, well, we need a system where anyone can have power, so we're gonna, you know, we're the rich people, we're the ones who are gonna have the power, not just those guys who happen to be born correctly. But Westeros doesn't, you know, have that. I don't even think that the mercantile people amongst Westeros really think of themselves as like being fundamentally eligible to have power in the way that like you would need for at least democratic leanings to develop.
True.
What do you guys think?
But you are kind of describing Tywin Lannister's position as being very rich and powerful and wanting power but not being able to get it because he has no claim to the throne.
Hillary, what do you think?
I mean, I agree that that sort of has shades of Tywin to it. But I think that, again, obviously someone like Tywin Lannister is distinguished in the fact that he can't ever have the Iron Throne for himself, but he can obviously get his family onto the Iron Throne, whereas the merchant class of Westeros, even if they're outrageously rich, could never have any hope of that at the present time anyway. I think that you're probably right. I think that the first step in sort of developing a slightly more democratic form of functioning in Westeros is going to be allowing people with wealth to have some sort of political influence, even though it might not necessarily be on the same level as the nobility. It at least sort of gives normal people the opportunity to possibly have that kind of power despite not being born into a super powerful family.
To springboard off of that for a second, I think that what determines where Westeros will be going politically, God, this is weird. This is a weird part of my life, is how the monarchy is dissolved. Is it a peasant uprising? Is it abstaining the throne? Is it being conquered by someone? That'll determine. If Euron Greyjoy's fleet bring about a Cthulhu-esque apocalypse, then sure, Kingsmoot all the way, that could happen. It would probably be very different, because, like you said, it doesn't match the size of Westeros to do the same thing that they do on the Iron Islands, but it'll probably be deeply influenced by that. It's why it's so wild that at the end of Season 8, for some reason, everyone, like, even though there's still a Night's Watch, there hasn't been any talk of like democratic anything, which is how the Night's Watch has been doing everything up till now.
Yeah, I actually do, and this is another great segue. It's like, I do actually think it's important to think about like how democracy or anything else other than feudalism will develop will actually really depend on like how things are going to end. You know, George has been teasing us with a squid apocalypse or the White Walkers or, you know, and whatever happens in the future, if there's going to be some calamity, it could be the catalyst for some like new social change. How do you think... you know, that like, is that actually going to be relevant, or do you think that's just not that's going to come and go and it's going to be feudalism as usual? Hillary?
No, I don't think it's going to be feudalism as usual. Firstly, I expect that at the end of the story, most of the kingdoms are going to split up into individual kingdoms again, especially places like Dorne, the North, Iron Islands, even the Vale. Mm-hmm. They're culturally and geographically distinct enough that it doesn't really, I mean, it never really made sense for them to be a part of one country. And obviously the only reason they became a country in the first place is because the Targaryens invaded and forced them to. So I think a great deal of them are going to want to split up, and that totally makes sense. And I don't think that it's going to be feudalism as usual, simply by virtue of the fact that so many people who are in positions of power are going to be dead, that it's going to force the table to grow in terms of like having more women who might have power, having more non-noble born people who have power.
It's going to be Sansa's time.
What?
It's going to be Sansa's time if she doesn't get killed.
Right. Well, yeah, exactly. Sense. I mean, to be honest, I do think that that's going to be at least a partially driving force as to why she's going to become a leader, is because even despite the fact that, you know, it's not like society's going to suddenly not be misogynistic, it's just going to be that there's going to be very few people who are even in a position to be able to lead.
Hmm.
That's a really interesting position, you know, because in the real world, after the Black Death, you know, one of the major catalysts for the transformation of feudalism out of, you know, from Europe out of feudalism was the Black Death, where so many people died that there were fundamental shifts in labor, you know, because now all the people who could do all the work, you know, they were way more in demand because they had survived, they didn't die. And so normal people got more bargaining power. They got the ability to now, you know, demand higher wages for their work and stuff like that. And that led to a catalyst, which would eventually spawn, you know, stuff like the Renaissance. So I'm kind of obsessed with this idea that it won't be feudalism as normal. What do you think is more likely to happen?
Can I pitch a counter argument?
Sure.
Go ahead.
A shogunate. Because think about it. If it is a war with the White Walkers, or a war with anyone, the people who are going to be the most highly valued are the ones who are the best at fighting. So, if they depose the king, who is currently like a 13-year-old boy or something, they depose him or make him a figurehead and then create a military government, i.e. a shogunate, who's to say they won't retain power after they win the big fight?
Hmm. How likely do you think that is, Hillary?
I mean, I think it's unlikely just by virtue of the fact that, like, Bran is going to be a 13-year-old boy, you know, physically, but the whole idea behind him being the three-eyed crow, the three-eyed raven, whatever,
About Tommen.
You're talking about the books.
Yeah, the books haven't ended yet. We know how the story ends in the show.
Right. Don't know.
25-year-old tree.
Right.
A shogunate is certainly an interesting idea. I don't know if that necessarily jives with what Martin is putting down, right? Because he's not writing these books to be like, wow, feudalism is great, guys. We should totally do feudalism. Arguably, the whole point of the books is that feudalism is bad.
Right.
I don't necessarily see the point of him writing this entire epic story you know, and then ending it with, oh yeah, the best guy who did sword fighting gets to be in charge.
Yeah,
and-
but we're just talking about things that could make sense. Like, obviously this is all going to end. Also, but George has, in interviews, said it'll be bittersweet. The ending, like the end of The Lord of the Rings, where Frodo has to leave and go to the Elflands because he got changed by his journey to Mordor and he can never return to his old life, and then the Shire gets burned down. Like, the end of Game of Thrones could, Song of Ice and Fire, could be just as bittersweet, where we survive the White Walkers and things, but no one learns their lesson. And we just go back to feudalism.
Oh, no.
Yeah, that could be it. Bam. Shogunate. It's more likely than you think.
No! That feels like psychic damage.
Yeah, I mean, I would tend to agree that from a narrative standpoint, I think that's extremely unlikely, just in terms of, like, obviously George takes a lot of different inspirations from historical events or whatever, but looking at it from an author perspective, ultimately, whatever the story he's telling, he thinks that it's worth telling. You know what I mean? So having it sort of end on a status quo that is pretty similar to what existed before seems unlikely. It just isn't, like, very exciting in terms of storytelling.
You know, everyone talks about how, you know, George is always subverting expectations. What if the ultimate subversion of expectations is that, oops, we're just resetting the clock?
That could be.
Time is a flat circle, guys.
Yeah, it could be just that this is all cyclical. This is how the last feudalism started.
Azor Ahai, oh, it all makes sense.
He was the prince that was promised. We never had princes before that.
Oh, God. That's super cynical, I think. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I don't think any of this is going to happen, but I do think it's fun to consider the possibility, and it makes a shocking amount of sense.
It does. You know how the fandom is losing its mind, and everyone is now, like, coming up with even wackier and wackier conspiracy theories?
No.
Yeah.
I feel like
all of my conspiracy theories are sane.
Yeah, that it's because you've got the tinfoil on. Right? Your mind is uncorrupted by the brain waves coming out of the rest of the fandom.
Yeah,
where everyone is a secret horse, and
everyone is a secret horse. You can't change my mind.
Again, you know, this is what happens when people don't have closure for years and years, right? But I do agree that it does kind of make sense, but, you know, I don't want that to be the case. I really want the end of, hopefully the end of the story will be, you know, maybe people learn some lessons about how to build a better society. But then again, if George is borrowing inspiration from the Scouring of the Shire, then I don't know if that really goes anywhere. It's just a personal story about how you can't.
We've talked about this. What's the Shire in Game of Thrones? It's probably Winterfell.
The North? Hillary ideas?
I'm not a super Lord of the Rings expert, so I don't know. I would agree that, you know, Winterfell seems like a sort of obvious potential option, but in terms of, like, this.
Probably is.
What?
Sorry.
No,
it's
go
probably
ahead.
King's Landing.
Yeah, that would also make sense, just in terms of, like, sort of where you expect the story to end. Like where would there be a scouring necessary, basically? You know what I mean? Like, I feel like Winterfell's probably going to get trashed in the Long Night, but I think that by the time the story ends, it's probably going to be somewhere in the south. So the scouring of the Shire... Go ahead.
The Shire is very representative of what, like, Lord of the Rings is about. It's the fight of good and evil, with good being this sort of down-to-earth, wholesome community of farmers, and evil being this, like, industrial machine eating up the landscape. King's Landing is far more representative of what Game of Thrones is about, which is a facade of a beautiful city over the desperate and ugly struggle for power, rather than Winterfell, which is just like a happy day camp for lost boys.
Right.
And wolves.
Yes. a boy and their dogs.
I guess it's difficult to speculate because we don't know, and we don't know if we'll ever know, you know, because we don't know if the books are ever going to come out. And I feel like that kind of drives people to a little bit of madness.
Oh, yeah, this is all conjecture. It's like Afrofuturism.
Yeah, we're solarpunk, I guess. You know, we're speculating about stuff that we rightfully have no way of knowing if it'll ever be true. You know, we could all be dead in the ground. And the cyber ghost of George R. R. Martin finally releases, you know, The Winds of Winter in like the 22-100.
This podcast is like becoming that. Bittersweet. Okay, yeah. Let's pull this back on track. Hillary, could pick one feudal system for Westeros to go for, which one would you pick?
One feudal system?
Well, one system. Sorry, I threw the word feudal in there for no reason.
What do you think they could actually do?
It can be your craziest theory or whatever.
I think that something along the lines of a representative republic could happen. I mean, I don't think it's going to be a super developed form, but I think that if I'm right and a lot of the kingdoms do split off, that would obviously make it easier. And so having, you know, delegates representing certain areas, representing certain areas of expertise, would make a lot of sense.
Okay. So it would basically be like you subdivide all of the different areas of Westeros into like small little like villages, and then you sort of build a republic from that bottom level all the way up.
Yeah.
Okay. Callum, what about you?
I think that the Euron Greyjoy apocalypse is going to happen, and it's going to create a Pangaea effect that will split apart the Seven Kingdoms into seven literal kingdoms.
Literal kingdoms. That's fun.
And then they will each have their own ruler with distinct cultures.
And then the Game of Thrones will repeat again.
No, and then they will construct giant land bridges. And the greatest threat will be, what do we do about tourism and travel?
If they do that, I really hope that the naval battles are much more prominent, because I will forever grumble about the naval battles in A Song of Ice and Fire. They're really just blech.
I mean, dude, like, the Ironborn are supposedly seafaring masters of the ocean, and they go into battle wearing full fucking plate mail on a ship.
That's not completely ahistorical.
Yeah, but it's stupid.
Again, it's not completely stupid, because, you know, they do fight boarding actions, right? It's just, how would they sustain such a large fleet? And, like, there are so many questions that have never been answered.
Why would you bother with a large fleet? It doesn't seem like anyone else has a fleet.
Again, you know, there's so many questions. Like, how is the, like, royal fleet used? How do ship battles happen in Westeros? None of that stuff is ever explained. That's going to be... One day, I'm going to corner George at a convention or something, and I'm going to demand an explanation.
Kick him, you know, in the mouth.
Forget Aragorn's tax policy. I want to know about what the Master of Ships actually does in Westeros.
Right, and we'll know. I agree. Why they would have such a huge royal fleet, for instance. Like, at least with the Ironborn, it makes sense. And usually when you look at, like, historically powerful naval countries like England or something, like, it makes sense that they would have a lot of ships, because it's a complete necessity for their life in general. But to just sort of have, you know, big fleets seemingly doing nothing for a ton of time, yeah, doesn't really make it. It seems like a weird waste of resources.
Yeah, it makes no sense to me.
How much trading do you think that they do? Like, with Braavos?
Again, one of the problems that has existed is that, like, no one writes naval history correctly in fantasy stories. Everyone kind of just, like, jumbles up all different types of periods of history into one. Like, for example, one major problem with the Middle Ages is they don't have ships that can go over the ocean. So it's not until, like, the 1500s that they develop things like a cog that can actually travel over the ocean without capsizing, right?
That's
boring. All the ships... Yeah, but you see, this is the thing. It's like, they have shipbuilding technology from hundreds of years in the future.
Well, what about Vikings?
Longships can't travel that far, man. They're not that good as ships. A real proper you know, medieval warship would easily be able to defeat a longship. How the Ironborn don't always get their butts handed to them is, again, something...
Because they're the only ones with a fleet. They're just raiding each other, Emilio. It's why the Iron Islands are poor. Tell me about your government.
Right. So, you know, I'm a libertarian socialist.
Gross.
Or at least I try to be. But obviously I don't think that's going to be possible in Westeros. I kind of think that the kind of political system that would make the most sense for the next evolution would be something like a federated monarchy, or like a system like the Holy Roman Empire, where you have these independent areas, these principalities or whatever, like many of them. They're all ruled by either a prince or like a noble house or a clan or something. And they each kind of vote on who gets to be the emperor of the whole mess. you know, that I could see becoming, like, if we go with your idea, you know, that all the kingdoms are going to be broken up and Westeros is going to fall apart as like under the Iron Throne. You know, maybe they could have an alternative would be, yeah, they have some kind of electorship like the Holy Roman Empire, which is a complete dysfunctional mess, you know, but I think that kind of suits the theme. For Westeros, and then you can have many distinct geographic areas that can nevertheless still want to try to put an elector, you know, or they want to put some guy on the throne that they want, you know, for not like a, because the emperor wouldn't be like a full-on, you know, Targaryen type emperor type person. It would be more of an elected position with some additional, you know, powers and stuff like that. That's what I think, a federated type monarchy. That's what I think could potentially happen. But yeah, I don't know. It's fun to speculate, which is why we're on this podcast, you know, because I like having these conversations. It's just unusual to think about, like, what could happen. But we really don't know.
I mean, I've been picturing a surf contest in my new Pangaea Westeros. God, that's
what
awesome.
What would the continent name for one continent that's every...
Well, it would be like archipelagos. Or something, yeah. Arc Westeros.
Oh, Lord. Okay, well. You know, it wouldn't surprise me if written in the margins of some notebook that George has is just like a scribble that says Arc Westeros, and then he crosses it out and he goes, Panatos under that.
yes. The only sensible option.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it... Okay, there's one last thing that I think we should talk about. People who know their history will know that previously there were attempts in, like, the Middle Ages and in the early Renaissance for, like, what we would call, like, primitive communists, you know, people like the levelers and so on. I wanted to ask you guys about, like, the role that religion could have in maybe equalizing society, because it seems like all the religions that exist in Westeros are, like, all about power and hierarchy. So maybe one of the other consequences for all of this crazy nonsense, you know, squid apocalypse, all of that stuff, will be a new religion emerges that rejects all of those other things and helps socially transform society in a new way.
Well, I mean,
what do you think about that idea?
Isn't that possibly what the apocalypse is going to be? That the old gods are this, like, alien hive mind that's sending the White Walkers to convert all of humanity into the hive mind? Or that, like... No, sorry. They're not sending the White Walkers. They're trying to fight against them. But they're trying to, like, basically upload everyone's brains into the hive mind so that even if their physical bodies die, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, the deep ones are different from the... Old gods?
The old gods are the tree people. The deep ones are the ones that maybe built the high tower and are fish people.
Yeah, what do you think, Hillary?
About the development of a new religion post-apocalypse?
And also the religious death matches between the squid gods and the...
The fish versus tree.
Yeah.
Well, so I think it's interesting because most of, aside from the faith, religions like the old gods and the drowned god and whatever, aren't really that hierarchical, nor are they really developed religions. They seem to have some sort of basis in fact, which I think is, you know, an interesting potential parallel with a new possible belief system developing after the apocalypse happens. That there seems to be some sort of reality behind things like the old gods, and even the drowned god. There seems to be some evidence that they exist. R'hllor, obviously, there seems to be some sort of evidence that it exists. So I think that it is possible, but it's also a little frightening to think of, you know, people developing a new religion after something absolutely catastrophic and terrible has happened.
Yeah. But like we talked a bit about this before the episode. Like I said, I think if society were to collapse, the first thing we would do is probably build something to keep us stable, like some sort of almost memorial seems like the wrong word, but something that like is familiar. And religion or structure would be the best.
Yeah, but as a counterpoint, what if it's like everyone has a sort of a spiritual shock from all of like, okay, because something that you did bring up, Hillary, which is not, you know, applicable in our world, is that like religion is kind of true.
Right.
Yeah, it's like magic.
Yeah.
It's kind of like real.
You don't like, you know, no giant squid god is going to come out of the ocean and be like, well, I guess the guys who were worshipping me on like 4chan were correct.
Right. You know? Yeah.
The spaghetti monster descends from the sky and makes 4chan the only nation.
Yeah, so we kind of don't know what would happen because we don't have an idea of like what would, we don't know how societies respond to real religious revelations, you know, because it's something like so fundamental that I don't really know if we can even say, you know, here's a model of what could happen. It's an interesting idea, certainly, but I think we just don't know.
I think the most interesting thing about the religions in like the old gods and the deep ones and stuff is that Westeros isn't the only place you can find evidence of them. Because isn't there like a tree in the Garden of Bones in the second book or something that Daenerys looks at?
Yeah, and there's a...
It's very Weirwood-like.
Yeah, and there's a toad.
Yeah, on like the Basilisk Isles or something. Or Toad Island.
And yeah, and there's all that stuff in... What's that place? Sothros?
Sothros.
Sothros. Yeah. Yeah, that place. It's like...
There's a bunch of that oily black stone that supposedly the deep ones used to build things, and apparently that's maybe what a shy is made of.
I think so. Yeah, I know there's a couple of different weird black stones, but I know that the oily black stone is a consistent theme that is found in a lot of different places, including Westeros and Sothros, I think.
And maybe that's the twist. Maybe the real twist will be that there'll be some kind of great spiritual conflict, and the lesson that we're supposed to learn from Game of Thrones, The Song of Ice and Fire, will be, actually, maybe you should be worshipping Cthulhu.
Right.
That would be horrible. That would be the worst thing you could do, George. Please don't do that.
No, I mean, given the way that things are going with R'hllor, given that there are a lot of people who follow R'hllor who are like, you know, ultimate Dany stans, understandably, because she has like the ultimate firepower. And considering that Dany is probably going to kill millions of people by the time the book is ended, I think that that's obviously a pretty like sort of anti-religious stance for George to be taking. So I don't think he's going to have other religions that he's like, oh, this is the right religion, but this religion is unhinged and gets tons of people killed.
Yeah, it also makes more sense that R'hllor is actually the evil one, like is the dark person.
Right.
Because R'hllor's the whole...
Aren't they all kind of evil?
But the whole religion of the Lord of the Light is like, the Lord of Light is the one fighting against the dark one, and the dark one is supposed to be like the White Walkers or whatever. But it makes more sense that the Dark One is tricking people and pretending to be the Lord of Light.
I mean, I think they both are. I agree that, like, overall religions, all of the religions seem to be, like, bad. You know what I mean? There aren't really any ones where you're like, oh, the effects of this are really good for society.
Oh, and
yeah, because the basis of all magic. Oh, sorry.
No, no, I was just about to say, like, it makes sense that the message would be religion is kind of stupid because, I mean, isn't that the whole point of the Faceless Men? Is that, like, their god is just death, and every religion has some sort of death god in it, and it's just this one thing that has many faces, and it's the only thing you should worship.
Yeah, I don't know if the if that's necessarily a religion in the same way. It's also kind of an ideology, but the thing that I was just going to say is that, like, I think the reason why all of it is messed up is because magic is literally life force, you know? Like, all magic demands a sacrifice of some kind.
Right.
And therefore, power is blood. And if power is going to be blood and, you know, the gods are real, then the gods are also going to be blood.
Yeah, it's kind of wild, though, because, like, what makes king's blood king's blood? Do you have to be elected and in office for your blood to be considered king's blood?
I don't think that's ever explained, you know? I don't feel like if you kill the Sea Lord of Braavos, you would be able to cast a magic spell.
I mean, yeah, but like, what's
I mean, I think it's like the vibes. I think just like
it's
if
the
you're...
Because
it's very sort of mutable, you know what I mean? There, like, a lot of blood seems to qualify as king's blood or royal blood, even if you wouldn't consider it in a technical sense to be royalty.
I mean, yeah, like, Drogo's blood is king's blood, isn't it?
Right.
Back when he was alive, because he was a Carl. A Carl. Wait, Drogo is a Carl, and he has a lot of marks on his body.
No.
It's all coming together.
And I think that's a good sign that maybe we should end the podcast.
Thank you so much for watching. Listening. Please go and check out Hillary's channel. Hillary, would you like to plug your content?
Absolutely. Again, I'm Hillary. My YouTube channel is Hills Alive. I do mostly stuff about A Song of Ice and Fire, Game of Thrones, Fire and Blood, House of the Dragon. So if you're interested in any of that stuff, then come check it out.
I recommend the content. It's the most, I think, the most nuanced perspectives, right? You're not going to get some... partisan nonsense.
Thank you. I agree. I have the most nuanced perspectives out of anyone who has ever made content about A Song of Ice and Fire.
It just happens that you're always correct.
Right. Exactly. I just have all the correct opinions.
Hell yeah.
Callum, why don't you plug our show?
Oh, yeah. And our show stuff that you're watching right now. You can there's more of it. I know.
Yes, there is.
If you subscribe to our channel, you'll get more of it. On a possibly monthly basis, even. But there's tons more episodes you can watch. We really need to get our watch hours up, so please go and do that. We're trying to shoot for 1,000 subscribers so we can finally monetize ourselves. But if you want to help us monetarily aside from that, then you can go and check out our Patreon, which has a bunch of bonus scenes, deleted scenes, scenes that no one requested, scenes that no one asked for, and scenes that no one wants. But you can go and watch it anyway. And if you don't want to pay for it, then you can go and check out the relief fund that's in the description of this video. A little while ago, Turkey and Syria suffered an earthquake attack. Is that what you would... I don't know.
No, they just had an earthquake. They didn't have an earthquake.
They got an earthquake happened. It makes sense. They had an earthquake happen. That sounds like they requested it. Okay, no, an earthquake happened there, and it was devastating, obviously. But there's a relief fund, you can go and donate money to it, and if you're going to do a good thing like that anyway, why not get something out of it? If you donate through this link, they will send you a letter thanking you for your donation. If you send that to me and Amelia, we will give you limited patron access for a few weeks, and you can go and watch all of the stuff up there.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, we've got some socials. You can find the links to that in our channel. Our Discord is free. Check it out. And we stream sometimes. Do you want to talk about the streams?
Yeah. We have at least a stream we do on Thursday, Callum and I. We're playing Wasteland 3, which is a fun CRPG. We're kind of taking over the Wasteland, dealing with politics, you might say. Callum wants us to overthrow a guy by the name of the Patriarch.
Obviously, why wouldn't we?
Yeah, and Then Callum, you have a stream on Mondays, I think it is.
Yes, I do. The content is undecided, and I also have a stream on Wednesdays with Miles from Largely Unemployed. And thank you very much to our patrons, Dorian and Liam Anderson, for supporting us at the $5 tier. If you want to hear your name read out, go and support us at that $5 tier as well. Have a good day.
Yeah, bye everyone.
Bye.
Bye-bye.